The Legal Lowdown on Kerry Today.
Yes, listener Miriam McGillicuddy is with us for The Legal Lowdown. Good morning to you, Miriam.
Sirs.
How are you doing this morning?
All good.
Very good, very good.
It looks fairly cheerful out there. Hopefully it'll keep dry.
Fingers crossed. It's meant to get nice before the weekend anyway.
Yeah.
Miriam, hopefully. Can I ask you, a couple of queries have come into us. I'm going to get straight to them this morning. And could you please ask Miriam, what's the easiest and cheapest way to change your name by deed poll? Miriam wants to know.
Yeah, I mean, it's great we have the deed poll available to us if we don't like our name and our birth cert, or we want to change our name for whatever reasons, that we can do this by deed poll. And it's really two quite simple documents, an actual document that says I want to change my name from, say, Mary Black to Mary White, for example. And then you sign it in the presence of a witness who then swears an affidavit that they saw you genuinely signing this. And then that's sent up to the deed poll office with accompanying documentation like proof of identity, proof of address and birth cert and all that. Because when you change your name by deed poll, if, for example, you're doing your passport afterwards, you'll have to show your birth cert and your deed poll. It doesn't actually amend the registry of birth or your name on your original birth certificate. But it's, as I say, there's information on the Citizens Information website, and it sets out exactly, it refers you to the court service office that has the forms. And if one wants forms for under 18s, one can email that office for them. Having said all that, the deed poll needs to be done on special paper, which is usually ordered by solicitors. It's called judicator paper. And so many things can go wrong with the deed poll, because the deed poll office checks it and it's got to be very precise. And most solicitors are very experienced in dealing with them. So it's probably a better idea to do it through a solicitor. So even though there might be an initial expense, it might save you expense down the line. Also, solicitors are able to do it by post, so they'd be able to save you the trip to Dublin. Because otherwise I think the deed poll office may require you to attend at the office. So that's the way you can theoretically do it yourself, provided you have the relevant judicator paper and you do it correctly. But as I say, it's very handy to pop into your local solicitor, and they probably, if they're your normal solicitor, they probably won't charge you too much for doing a deed poll.
Okay, very good. And then you have to go around and tell everyone they have to call you by your new name.
That's right. And Terry, you can say, I'm just using this new name and that's it, lads. But unfortunately, the banks and the institutions probably won't accept that. They need the paper. But people did it before and they just went by repute. And it's got a lot stricter nowadays. I mean, before, people used to be able to get away with nicknames and pet names and all that kind of thing. But now that has to be regularised in some way. And often it's unusual in Ireland. We don't have a lot of people changing their names from maybe to Georgie Best or something famous. That's done a lot in the UK. But we don't have that here, and it would be quite interesting. I'd say there's a whole master's thesis or PhD there on the method that people change their names, why people change their names in Ireland, because usually it's for to their pet name. So they're not actually changing their original name. It's usually something that's linked to their original name. So that's a whole thing around identity and all that. And there's a rich source of information there, I'd say, for a PhD.
There certainly is. That's for sure. Miriam, a listener says, I have a question for Miriam. It concerns the statute of limitations in relation to challenging a will. I understand beneficiaries have a time limit of 6 years from the date of death to challenge a will, and that children have 6 months from the date of the grant of probate. But if the 6 years have already gone, do the children still get 6 months after the grant of ProPet. The reason I ask is that July was the 6-year anniversary of my father's death, but it will probably be another few weeks before the grant of ProPet is issued. So I've been wondering, did my time run out in July, or do I still get the 6 months post grant of ProPet?
My understanding, but I'll look it up for this listener for next month, is it 6 months from grant of probate? Because very often when we're, say, acting for somebody who is looking at challenging the will as a child, you know, on the basis that they haven't properly been provided for, very often we put caveats into the probate office so we know when the grant of probate issues. And then once that issues, we know we've only a 6 months time limit to actually take action against the estate. The reason for that, Gerry, is that the estate is only validly constituted when the grant of probate issues. So we haven't anyone to really, we haven't formal people to sue on for our right and proper share until the grant of probate issues. And then we can sue the estate for our just and proper share. So that we've 6 months from the date of the grant of probate. So it's very tight. And yeah, often you need to have all your ducks in a row, all your, have to have your case assembled and have briefed a barrister to literally draft proceedings that are ready to go as soon as the grant of probate issues. Often with these things, once you sound off that you're going to do the section 117, I mean, the estate might come to the table and sort things out by agreement, because if it has to go to court, very often those costs will come out of the estate.
And that's an interesting point. There was an interesting piece in The Guardian at the weekend that I saw. Thousands go to war over inheritance as families bank on hereditary wealth. This is in England, apparently. More wills than ever are being challenged. Up to 10,000 challenged, the highest number at least a decade. And one of them was a £1 million battle between four siblings that went on for 7 years and was labelled out of control by a judge at the High Court. And they were talking, and this is just on the English side of it.
Yeah.
In some countries, including France, they force people writing wills to give a certain portion of their estate to their direct descendants. But in England and Wales, they're free to leave assets to whoever they wish because of a principle called testamentary freedom. But that is not absolute, so there still can be challenges. So, and there's blended families as well. The rise of blended families have opened up more challenges and kind of muddied the water. So it's probably going to go the same way in this country, I'd imagine.
I suppose really it's indicative of a society that's getting wealthier. So yeah, there's more to fight over.
There's more to be fought over.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's really it at the end of the day. And also people aren't going to roll over anymore. They want to stand up for their rights. And I suppose a lot of people might have felt over the years, oh, I should have done something about that, and lived all their lives regretting that they didn't do something. And often once they stand up and be counted and put themselves forward, ideally the family, everybody should come to the table and sort it out, rather than
the average case, and this was the average case, was £45,000 in the UK in that story. So that'll underline, I suppose, and that's the average case, not the other ones.
And like, the costs are on both sides. So there's the cost for the estate defending the case, and then there's the cost of the person bringing the case, which they then want to get from the estate if they've got a solid case. You know, usually now there have been cases here in Ireland where a judge hasn't given the costs because he said there's no reality to this case at all. You've been properly provided for already. You're not getting any costs here. But that's not, you know, not always the case. And very often we've loads of precedents where they have actually got the costs from the estate. And you see, it's where parties dig in their heels. Now, we've discussed this before on the radio, that there is mediation for these kind of succession cases. And these earlier people get into mediation, the better.
The better, yeah. Okay, Miriam, stay with us. We're going to talk more. We've more queries to get to on the Legal Lowdown. We'll get to those after these. Yeah, we're talking the Legal Lowdown with Miriam McGillicuddy. And Miriam, a couple of queries coming into us here. One of them asks, what are advanced healthcare directives and how do I put one in place for myself?
Yes, the advanced healthcare directives, these are a very good idea for everyone to do. Strictly speaking, at the moment, doctors would talk to next of kin and get their views and their feedback on what the patient would wish as well. But there's no legal authority for them to do that. And by putting in place an advanced healthcare directive, you give your next of kin and nearest and dearest authority to talk to the doctors and make your wishes known to the doctors, and those wishes have to be respected. So if you're out comatose on a table and can't talk, and your next of kin are trying to express your wishes to the doctors as to what your wishes are in relation to treatments, etc., once the advanced healthcare directive is in place, that gives that next of kin authority to liaise with the medical professionals. So they're they're free to do up through the decision support service. So they're a very good idea to have in place. Now, you can specify that you don't want treatments, for example, CPR, life-sustaining treatments, blood transfusions or whatever. You can also set out that you want all the life-sustaining treatments that are out there, but that's not legally binding because it depends on hospital resources, obviously. But they're, as I say, a great thing to have in place. You can also do one through the Think Ahead website, thinkahead.ie. And what ideally we put in place these, we sign them in the presence of two witnesses, one of whom must not be a family member. And we specify who our advanced healthcare representative would be, which should usually be, if people have partners, should be their wife or partner, and might be a child as well, a grown-up child. And they can appoint a sub as well in case those people are not able to act at the particular time. And ideally, we'd review them every 10 years. But they're a good thing to have in place. They've been made legal and they're available to do through the decision support service. So we can all do them up literally for free. And once we've the MyGov ID, we can pop into the site and there's a form we can print out. Now, unfortunately, there's no register of these forms yet. Hopefully there will be down the line, because say, for example, if I was involved in a road traffic accident, ideally personnel on the scene
would be able to access and find out in the hospital,
would arrive one of those or not. And hopefully that'll be the way it'll go down the line.
Yeah, it makes sense. How can one remove a private right of way on one's land? What if it's public? How does one remove this?
Yeah, I mean, sometimes people get very upset about rights of way over their land, and they might be saying, oh, look, it hasn't been exercised for umpteen number of years and I want to get rid of it. Now, if they buy the adjoining land and that the right of way exists from, they can apply to remove it through the land registry, or else they can ask their adjoining neighbour if he hasn't used it for years, would he consider discharging it off their folio? And if they do, then that's great, because they can sign a document that can be sent into the land registry and the right of way can be removed. There is a simple procedure, but the owner of the right of way over one's land has to consent to it. Otherwise, one could apply on the basis that it hasn't been used for in excess of 20 years.
Okay.
Through the land registry.
Sure. Miriam, what's the maximum amount district court can order in relation to maintenance for a spouse or children?
Yeah, for a spouse it's €500 per week, and for children it's €150 per week. Now they're, I suppose, high enough really, but depending on somebody's income, I mean, the larger incomes, that mightn't be enough at this stage, and then people would have to go in the circuit court for a higher amount of money to keep them in the style, as it were, to which they'd become accustomed. I suppose 150, you know, it's low enough. I think they'd probably be looking at those limits as part of the court limits down the line.
Yes.
Because, say, a child with a disability or special needs, they might need more than that every week. And then it's standard to put on 50% of medical, educational and dental, which could be quite high every week as well, throwing it over the 150 per week. So I think they're probably going to have to look at that limit in the not too distant future.
Okay, and if that is, if it is a case of you're a family of more means, does it automatically go to a higher court for more payments or for higher payments?
Yeah, you'd have to go, like people might do it as part of a divorce as an overall package. Yeah. Or if they're not married or if they're cohabitees, similarly, they might be going in the upper court, the circuit court. But otherwise, even on its own, you can apply to the circuit court for higher amounts of money for a child if you needed it. And certainly if the person you were applying to for the maintenance had a very high income, you'd obviously be going in the circuit court so that you could get more to keep the child in, the manner to which it probably was accustomed.
Okay. A listener wants to know this morning, Miriam, redundancy and lump sum taxes. Is your first redundancy lump sum tax-free, or is it up to a certain threshold?
My understanding is it's up to a certain threshold, and I'll get that for the next month for that listener. I'll actually get the information into Trasa, and sure, she can relay it to the listener there. There's the revenue of a very detailed...
I think there's a lifetime limit of €200,000 in terms of payments made for death, injury, disability. But when it comes to exemptions, there's different exemptions that come in and qualify as well in terms of termination payments. There's a statutory redundancy, which is exempt from income tax, and universal social charge, which is the one that catches some people. But yeah, there are other ones as well, up to a limit.
Yeah, up to a limit. And then it depends on if some of that lump sum is constitutes wages or not. You know, if we're getting a WRC lump sum, for example, we won't term it wages. So I'll get the specifics on that for next month, Jerry, because we could go into that a bit more.
Yeah,
maybe look at how taxation of, for example, personal injuries awards and WRC awards.
Just have a look at that.
Yeah.
Interesting one. This is an interesting one, Miriam. Should I marry my partner of 30 years, so I won't have to pay tax if he dies and leaves me his house?
Yeah, I mean, this happens from time to time that we have to sit people down and say that really...
You need to regularise your affairs or plan.
Yeah. You need to get married, and that it's really a nice day out and you'll enjoy it. And I mean, the bottom line is that very often partners would have accumulated the house between them. They'd have spent years paying off a mortgage, and they're not married. And if either one of them dies, there is a large tax bill, and they might have accumulated savings and maybe even a holiday home as well.
Yeah.
So it's so important to look at that carefully. I mean, you could, if you were totally anti-marriage, you could put in place some kind of a policy to pay the tax. But why do that when simply tying the knot would sort it all out, and from a tax point of view? And it is putting pressure on people to get married, our taxation regime, there's no doubt about that. Yeah.
Okay, Miriam, listen, we're out of time, but thanks a million for another great installment of the Legal Lowdown. More again next month, and keep your questions and queries coming in. We'll pass them on to Miriam for this time next month. Thanks, Miriam. Have a great day.
Very much, Jerry. Take care.
There you go, Miriam. We'll get a release listener when it's on the line. If you have a view on that,